Welcome to the Chips and Tip Podcast. I'm Tim Paul from Toolpath, and we're joined by my buddy, Mark Terriberry from Haas Automation. Many people, you know him as the Haas Tip of the Day guy. I don't think that's entirely accurate. We'll get to that here in a little bit. But Mark, thanks for joining. Before we get super deep into your background, which I want to get into here in a little bit, tell me who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Mark Terriberry. Like you mentioned, I work for Haas Automation, which I've just got to mention is the largest machine tool builder in the Western world. So we sell a lot of machines, something like 1,000 machines a month. So imagine what you guys do in your shops, your machining, your programming. Now times that by 1,000 every single month. That's how big this industry is growing, just from our little neck of the woods. And so I'm a machinist by trade for a long time now. And at Haas Automation, I was hired in as an applications engineer, which just means that I know which buttons to press most of the time, or I know who does. And we just connect questions with answers.
Awesome. I want to get a little bit into your day-to-day here in a little bit. But I think the general format, I think I have bullet pointed out is I have a few questions. Talk a little bit about the Haas Tip of the Day. I think it's been a pretty big impact on the industry. So I'll ask you some questions about that. I want to learn more about you. You shared some of your personal past with me, how you kind of got into mechanical things, how that led to machining. I think you have a great story that kind of weaves through the machining industry and to where you're at now. I want to talk a little bit about mentorship and the education side of our industry. And then I just have some listener questions at the end, if that works out. So let's get right into it. I said earlier, a lot of people, when I say Mark Terriberry, they're like the Haas Tip of the Day guy. And I'm usually like, he's definitely one of them, but I think there's more than just a tip of the day person, right? How does Haas spread out the tip of the day workload to different people, and who is that?
So we've got a lot of different people making videos at any one time. They've had different series titles, like the Answer Man. Brian O'Fallon was Answer Man, so he was putting out those videos. Right now, we have so many new products with the Haas tooling side of things and new machines. There must be, a dozen people that are involved in one way or another making videos on specific products. Up to this point, I'm the only one that's made an actual branded tip of the day video that has a tip of the day logo on it, but who knows, that could change.
So you are the tip of the day.
Yeah.
Keep going.
You guys so far, but we've put out just a million different videos, and they were making videos long before I came to work for Haas. I was just fortunate enough to walk into it and get to do it full time.
Cool. All right, I did do a little homework, and I don't. The internet is a wonderful and terrible place, but it took me lots of directions. I, for the life of me, wanted to find the very first Haas Tip of the Day video. I found one topic that is pretty near and dear to my heart: hearing protection. Many people know me as One-Eared Tim. Some people think I lost my ear in some heroic machining accident or something. But I was just born that way. But with that, I do take pretty decent care of my one ear. And so I actually watched your video about hearing protection in the machine shop. Everybody should go find that. I watched way too many people, just blasting their ears, right? I am lucky that I can squint real good and cover one ear while I also blow parts off. But I am also super, super careful about protecting my ears.
I love that video, and it gets like no views at all. And it's a super important topic.
It's so important. Yeah. Especially I've done a lot of motorsports, right? Where we're 120 decibels, some of those sports. And I've always told people like the difference between 100 and 110 is exponentially crazy higher, right?
Yeah. It's like those, what's the earthquake Richter scale.
It's this
exponential scale. I think that the premise for the hearing protection video was my wife was hard of hearing and deaf. Oh. And so we got married, she was hard of hearing, and as we grew older, her hearing became less and less. And so it was always on my mind. I've seen so many audiologist reports where I could see that her hearing was getting less and less and in different ranges, you know, yeah. High pitches, okay, low voices like mine, or I'm kind of a whatever tenor voice, but it's, yeah. She was losing hearing. And I started looking at that for machinists, realizing, okay, mine's going down as well. Everyone I knew that was getting older was losing it. And during COVID, my wife realized that she had been reading lips for so many years that she couldn't understand anything.
No way.
And so she was completely deaf. So during 2020, 21, she lost all communications in that way. So she went and had a cochlear implant done where perforate the nerves, and it's a life changer for her. So that's now amazing. she can hear fantastic. It's amazing technology.
Oh yeah. Through my ear, I've learned more than about that than I wanted to. And someday if I jack up my good ear, I got like a satellite dish over here so I can hear pretty good, but I don't have an eardrum or anything in the one side, but it's super neat technology that I have gone down more than a few rabbit holes about. So, was that the first tip of the day video? That's actually the main point of that. Do you remember what the first tip of the day video was?
I do. They grabbed a cell phone. It might have been, it was an iPhone, probably 4. But it was, they grabbed it. We went out to the demo room, outside the demo room, and we shot some videos on tap retract speed.
Oh,
and so we have, you know, some settings that deal with that, but it's already integrated in there now, where if you tap in it, you know, whatever, you have a quarter 20 tap and you're feeding in it, you know, whatever, 50 inches a minute, it's going to back out at 4 times that speed by default. You can put a J value on your G84 line. It'll do the same thing. But you can also retract as fast as, let's say, 9 times. So even on my old machines, my Fanuc machines or whatever I was running, it was always a big thing. You always wanted to mess with that because if you're not cutting, why not just rip out of there and like go fast?
Yeah, when I discovered that 15 years ago or whatever, it did feel like a secret room in Mario Brothers or, you know, some kind of cheat code area where, I did a lot of contract programming. So when I would find stuff like that, the people I worked for thought I was just extra special.
Easy money.
Everyone
should.
Keep going.
That was the first real tip of the day. There is a video just prior to that where I think kind of like the same way they're doing right now. Everyone's making videos. They had everyone making videos at one time. And I got involved with one of Andrew Harnett's coolant videos. And so there's a video out there of me where I'm clean shaven, little chubby face. That's one of the first, that was probably the first video I ever did. And it was some coolant video. They saw that. And then I just spent a few years in the software department at Haas doing software testing. Mm-hmm. And then they moved me over to doing videos full time.
Man, a good takeaway there that at Toolpath, we're kind of learning as well. Is like, sometimes you just got to get started, right? I think it's real easy for a lot of people to think like, oh, Haas. I mean, Haas, clearly they've got a video department and all this stuff, right? But as I've gotten to know many of the people at Haas over the years, there's a get shit done kind of attitude, right? And I've tried to share the similar, you know, I hope I've done a decent job sharing similar with my team at Toolpath. It's like, let's just get something done and then we can make it better along the way, right? So just popping out with an iPhone, you know, being the start of the Haas tip of the day is a rad story. So that's great. I will spend some amount of time on the internet trying to find the clean shaven Mark Terryberry video. I'm weaving in some questions from other people about the Haas tip of the day. So somebody asked, and I messed up and didn't jot the name down, but I think I don't want to overstate it, but I think the Haas tip of the day videos were pretty important. You know, to me, they kind of marked a really important part of our industry where it's like a shift in knowledge for so long, or at least I've been in the industry for 25 years for a little while. So 25, 26 years. And it used to be like a protected thing behind pay for it, you know, or go be abused by some old timer until he, you know, liked you enough to share some of that knowledge, right?
Even then, he always shared so much.
Yeah, he did. And then always complained about the knowledge he didn't have. So when I was at Autodesk, we had this thinking of just share all the knowledge, try to connect people with people that knew things. And then we saw like kind of what we call the Insta Machinist community, right? Where they, it just seemed like a happier place where people shared knowledge. So I think the Haas tip of the day, and that's something that a listener asked specifically, was the Haas tip of the day has built a massive following. How has that impacted your career? And I think we're almost done with the tip of the day topics.
It's completely changed it in that I used to run a machine shop, didn't own it. I ran the machine shop, and then I was a director of machine operations at a different, you know, larger machine shop. So I was a machinist, or I was a manager, whatever I did. Right now, I am more in education than you know, manufacturing, yeah, engineering. Yeah. It's very different. And so it's completely changed my career.
Yeah, right. So before the tip of the day, your applications, you probably spent a lot of your day-to-day like answering like answer man type questions. Does that sound right?
Yeah. So we'd answer, there was a group of us and they still exist.
Yeah.
But I spent most of my time answering emails and, or on a plane. I'd spend maybe 50 or 70 days a year on a plane.
Okay. 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 Awesome. Well, I say, keep it up. I say, Brian or anyone, you know, running that budget, keep funding the tip of the day. Actually, I'll share just my own personal question about it. I love sharing info and content and all that stuff, but probably the hardest thing for me is deciding what I should do next. How do you guys go about that?
So I've got a list that I like, and right now my list is you know, hundreds of items long. There's some big ones that we still haven't attacked yet, but there seems like there's always something going on. This time last year, we were getting ready for IMTS. And so we had a lot of work to do for that. So the whole crew, all of marketing department was working on that. Right now, it was for the last 2 years, we've been starting Haas tooling.
Yeah.
So it's all hands on deck for Haas tooling. So a lot of the choices that we're making right now are made for us. We have to get out product videos for tooling as we start those, that side of things. And it's gotten huge, right? So it did, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Huge. Yeah. 50 million last year, 100 million next year. It's gotten big. Yeah. So some of those decisions get made for us. But I've been pretty lucky. They've been, usually about, I don't know, 6 out of 10 of the topics have been mine where I've just chosen one and just run with them. I still want to cover, you know, cutter compensation more in depth. Tool-nose radius compensation. Those require a lot of graphics, and so they're going to be expensive videos because they take the editor's time. Yeah, but generally speaking, I choose the topics. I write the scripts. Mm-hmm. We go and make the videos with an editor and talk them all through. Any video I've ever done, I've always sat down with myself and at least a couple guys, usually Andrew Harnett and Brian O'Fallon. And we'll kick it back and forth and try and make it better, and then we'll go and shoot it.
How much prep? I keep dragging it out, but it's so interesting to me. How many hours of prep do you think you have? At Autodesk, it was pretty easy, like an hour for every minute of like screen capture type content. But do you guys have any kind of recipe like that?
It's just impossible to say right now. It's really come down to the video editor's time because we've just got so much going on. And we've got, you know, half a dozen different editors at one time, maybe four at the very least. And so I'll be working on different topics, looking at manuals, reviews, that type of stuff. Yeah. So I have a lot of things simmering while it goes. But some of these videos have took a long time. We might have had, like, literally... Let's say like we had a that popular video with the tapping.
Yep.
Well, I didn't have anything else going on, nothing for a month, because the rest of the world was working on, you know, paying the bills, getting ready for IMTS show or emo. And so I had nothing to work on for a month when we made that video. So that's 160 hours at least on that video. And then another, you know, another 20 hours shooting it or whatever we spent on that particular video. That was a different video.
Yeah.
Tool holder video we did was a 30-minute movie, same thing. If it's a 4-minute video, chances are I spent 40 hours on it. I mean, it could have been 20, but it could have been 40. It depends.
It's clear when I watch them, because I a lot of the videos, like, I know basically the intent, like the main, main storyline, and like the dirty details. I love them and I watch them because of like all the, you clearly are doing like deep dive homework to tell a better, more entertaining story. So, historical stuff, all that is great. So, when I was at Autodesk, it was hard to justify spending the extra time to like make it amazing. So, good job on that. Let's move on to the reason I asked you to be here was because we've known each other personally for a while, and we've had a couple beers together and a few meals, and I've always really enjoyed poking at your, like, tell me about Little Mark stories. Like, how did you get into mechanical things? How did you get into, like, what piqued your first interest in machine? I say go as far back as you want, but I think for me, the important story for a lot of machinists is like, you know, how do they get interested and like learn the connect the dots with mechanical stuff? And then like the next big one was how they got into machining.
The mechanical side of things for me, I mean, it was always kind of there, but it really took a right-hand turn when I was about 13, 14. My mom bought me a set of tools from Costco, $100. You know, and then the clutch had gone out in her car, and she said, fix it. That was it. So I went down to the, you know, auto parts store and bought a Chilton's and pulled up the transmission and did it all wrong and put it back together again and got greasy and bloody and just made it work. But it was so much fun because as you're doing that, you're looking at all these holes, right, and bolts and nuts. You can't spend that many hours wrenching on stuff. And since then, I've changed literally hundreds of clutches. I was kind of an amateur mechanic when I was a kid, right? So I've changed just dozens and dozens of engines and transmissions and that kind of thing. But you can't pull out so many bolts without wanting to know how those holes got there. And so it was so cool for me in that starting out as a mechanic. And eventually, I went on to poke those same holes in engine blocks, right, and cylinder heads, this kind of stuff, where I was the guy putting the holes in the parts. And those questions were always there. How did they make this? And so it's just the coolest thing for me to have lived a life where I was able to become the guy that made it.
Yeah, that's great. Two follow-up questions that popped up for me was the first one was with your mom. So she, first of all, I think every parent should buy their kids, boys, girls, you know, 2-year-old, 10-year-old, whatever, their own set of tools. I think that's a fundamental belief of mine. My daughter is quite the little mechanically inclined little lady. She's pretty proud of her little tool set. And it's nothing super fancy, but your mom's like, hey, Mark, go fix it. That begs the question of like, where did she get that attitude of like, we can fix our own stuff?
So her dad, kind of morbid, but so her father, when she was very young, he worked at the local service station. He was a mechanic, and he died after a hydraulic lift dropped like 4 inches, gave him a little bonk on the head right before it catches, you know, you click, 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 yeah, and it's that little click. And so it dropped, gave him a little bonk on the head. He went home for lunch, fell asleep, never woke up. No, and so her father was a mechanic when she was young. And her mother remarried and she had a great father influence there as well. But so she had that memory of this man who was like, you know, that loved her, took care of her. He had built race cars, raced them at Ascot Park, that kind of stuff, little midget stuff. But So she was always around this mechanical type stuff. And then her grandfather, my great grandfather, also taught machining and was a machinist. And so she always had those type of ideas growing up, where in Orange County, he would go and even me as growing up, I remember seeing his like little steam engines, Stanfield. He would make these little models and take them to the county fairs. And so there was always this mechanical tone in the background. I think that she loved it, and she loved the men that were in her life, and that she always wanted me to have that mechanical stuff. So she poured into that, and she had a lot of broken down cars. And Datsun 510.
Oh,
clutch on.
Only a bazillion dollars per day.
That's funny. Yeah, pickup truck, same thing. I changed the engine on her Volvo. Yeah. All that stuff before I was 15, 16.
What a gift. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's a huge gift. I was raised in a family of, maybe too extreme. I will say too extreme. You don't pay anybody to do anything because you can do everything. And it was a hard transition later in my life, like similar right around now, where like I have, not that I'm wealthy, but I have more money than time many times. And I'd rather pay someone to work on my car so I can work on my dirt bike, because I don't trust anybody to work on my dirt bike, right? And then you mentioned the Chilton manual. I haven't thought about a Chilton manual in a long damn time.
Right? Damn. When's the last time this is why we started. This is how I got the job. I mean, I'm literally paid in some ways to make educational stuff, but videos. I fix stuff all the time. Right now, it's mainly about just Googling. You go on YouTube, you find out what does this code mean? Like, okay, it's an O2 sensor left bank. And you figure it out. But the general manager at Haas, Bob Murray, he got a flat tire. This is a story. He got a flat tire in his Raptor, his Ford truck, and he pulled over and he didn't grab the manual. He grabbed his phone and just looked it up on YouTube and said, where's the stupid jack? He doesn't even know where the jack is, right? He can change the tire if he just knew where the stupid jack was.
The tools were,
So he Googled it, and that was it. And he Googled it, he found it, and then he realized that night when he came home, his son was talking about some video game, probably Fallout, I think. And so he was playing that game and talking about, you can't get past this level unless you go into the refrigerator in the desert and go right. So his son was playing this game, and how did he figure out how to get past it? He went on YouTube. He came the next day and said, hey, you're making videos. We're going to start a series called Haas Tip of the Day. I don't know where the name came from. As far as I know, it was Bob Murray. Could have been somebody else.
But it rolls off the tongue pretty easy.
He's like, whatever, here it is. Just do it. Yeah. And we're going to put some effort into that, because that's how people get their information today. That's how he got his information, how his son got the information. And we needed to fill that gap.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. You literally just like rushed a whole bunch of memories back through my head with the Chilton. I was in my dad. My dad was a fix anything. There's a book about everything. He had not a lot of books about philosophy, but he had a hell of a lot of books about small block Chevys and all the. I mean, it's like, I wanted to learn about engines. He was like, there's the book about, engines. And I would never buy a car without going to Knapp Auto Parts and buying the Chilton manual. Like, I literally never bought a car without, like, that was step one.
That was the first thing you did.
Yeah, I taught a bunch of friends how to work on their cars, like, just to understand the concepts of brake calipers and all that. And I was like, got to go to Napa. Now it's just all there in your pocket. So that's cool.
So the Chilton manuals for cars. I used to have the Thomas guides for math, right? What were the big green books that we had in the machine shops? Everyone had to stack this row of green books that would tell you the sources. It wasn't Thomas. And I have Thomas.
Oh yeah. Thomas is, there's a Thompson like business manual,
guides. We have those. And so if you needed a rod in for whatever, you'd look in those giant green books and you'd call someone in Connecticut and go buy it. Yeah. But there was no national yellow pages and no internet. So you had to look it up in a book.
Yeah, I just last night, 2 nights ago, my daughter was talking trigonometry, and I was like, well, let me show you where the cheat codes for that are. And talking about cheat codes again, right? I like to go to my very first tab in my machinery's handbook, and I've got like all the, like, you don't need to remember all this crap. It's all right here. Yeah, what a neat time. I mean, I think we've been blessed with seeing that both sides of that. So I think we're of similar vintage.
Information has never been so free flowing, like you said. Yeah. I mean, hopefully with the Haas machines, if there's something you need, just Google it and hopefully you can find it. If not, send an email to TOD@HaasCNC.com. Yeah. we'll make a video on it. But that's
some notes on that. Yeah. Okay. So you gave a very abbreviated version of how you got into mechanical stuff. You did make a connection over to holes in transmissions and now I'm drilling transmissions. But yeah, I'm trying to think how much of your story. You had a truck you used to break a lot. I don't know if there's much there other than just fun stories.
We took our Jeeps and we would, weld on Jeep running gear, right? So we were always jumping our old Datsun trucks and rolling them. And we've gone through a lot of, we took a Buick V6 231, dropped it into an old Chevy Love, right? Made a pre-runner out of that. So we were always just doing silly stuff. I lived in San Diego County, kind of out in the sticks. Yeah. In North County, and so we could go and do whatever we wanted, and that was a lot of fun. And so I was always working on something. When I was a kid, I had my first car would have been a Datsun pickup truck that a friend of a friend had driven into the ocean, and so I bought that. Thought I was going to look at this, a great truck is so cheap, and I gave up on that after a year. After everything just kept breaking, But my first car after that was a 68 Camaro with a straight six, 250.
Yeah. So put an 70 and a half Camaro was my first.
It's a cool looking.
My first driver's license car. That's what I'd say. I had some wood before that, but
everything I had when I was young was that. But the 68 Camaro, and then went to a 70 Nova. But all of those were put an engine in it, get it all the way you want it, and then sell it and start over. Yeah. Working on something.
That's cool. I try to think of, I had Dylan Jackson on the podcast last week, and he's an expecting father of a daughter. And somebody asked, like, for me to give dad advice. And I was like, my science experiment is still in motion. Like, let's see, go back in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it did. But, yeah, so I'm always trying to think of ways to, like, encourage kids to, like, try stuff, break stuff, try stuff. Now you just, I don't see much kids, like, dropping engines into things and, breaking them and figuring out how to fix them. So I look for opportunities to teach that.
They're still watching. I played board games. My kids hated board games. Okay. And I'd make them play, and we'd all play board games. And so I've got shelves of them in the other room. And you think that they're not playing, they hate it. And all of a sudden, they come over with their friends, and what are they doing? They're showing their friends the board games. Yeah. Same thing with changing brakes. Every time I'd change brakes, I'd make my son go out and do the last little bit. Even if he didn't do it, he was there. And never thought anything was sticking. And all of a sudden, one day, he's got his friend over, and he's changing the brakes on his car. Oh yeah, I can do that. And he can't do it. He really wasn't there yet, right? He was young. But he figured it out, like we all did, because he thought that he could. And
that's the important thing right there.
He'll figure it out.
That's the important thing right there. With my daughter, I very much jokingly say it, but she loves to be like, she's like, no, let me do it. Just enough to say she did it and she could do it. I have this nightmare of a very, very long Jeep build. She's TIG welded on there. She's MIG welded on there. She's run some wires, like a couple of wires, but she'll tell, I'm sure, I haven't heard it, but she'll tell a lot of her friends she's building it. So Now, how?
I remember I sent that picture there a few months ago of my my TIG welder tan. I lost my camera here. We'll try and set this up again.
Let's fix that again.
Let me try it again. I apologize for that.
No, I can edit that out.
I have to reconnect here and re-edit back in.
I mean, I can hit the camera thing and see what that does. You want me to do that?
No, I've got to set this thing back. Oh, maybe integrated microphone. Yeah, try and do that again.
Okay. So I just clicked it. There we go.
There we go. Do we still have audio?
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Sounds good. Okay, to me.
I was getting another.
So you got your TIG welding tan?
I got my TIG welding tan. I thought I was going to tack weld something, but it was going so good. So good. I just finished it up. Yeah. And man, silliness.
What's that?
Your welds on your Jeep were just gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. Being a decent welder was high on my list of things to accomplish someday. So I took a job doing some fabrication at one time, and actually why I learned about flash burn, the hard way. Have you ever had flash burn on your eyeballs?
No.
Okay.
No, thank goodness.
So for anybody that knows, Mark sent me a picture of his soft baby skin on the inside of his arms with a nice red. I don't know if I'd call it a tan, but it was definitely colored. I learned about flash burn. I grew up around welding, but I had a nice welding hood and I got a job as a welder. So I took my nice welding hood to work and then I had to weld something at home to go on a dirt bike ride. I was doing something on my trailer and I was like, oh, I can weld. I can put a nice bead with my eyes closed on this. And I did. And it was actually very respectable TIG weld bead with my eyes closed. But man, it felt like I had sand in my eyes about 2 hours later. It just burned right through my eyeball, my eyelids. And I called my dad, who used to be a professional welder. And, he got a really good laugh out of that. And he's like, yep, can't do that. So, let's make the connection between, you fast forwarded probably a bunch of time to, changing clutches to drilling holes in engine blocks and heads. So, how'd you make that jump?
I was going to school. So I got married pretty young. I got married at 18. We waited 8 years to have kids, but my wife and I just had a lot of fun. We traveled. So we already had our retirement when we were young, but I was going to school. I was, just taking classes for a degree and I was in a properties and material class. And he said, go get a job. I've said this before. Get a job someplace where there's engineers, where there's design work, where there's machining, something that's going to actually help you in the future. And at the time, I was embarrassingly, I'll say it, I was installing payphones. But I was making bank. I was like, man, I was making good money there installing payphones. And so I took this job in a machine shop and quit my job making good money and was just swapping parts in a machine shop. Where they had engineering work, and obviously you're working with designers. And it was the coolest thing ever. It just blew me away. I'm like, this is the coolest thing. And I got lucky. The first part that I made was in some aluminum skateboard deck. And so it was really simple, right? Only, a couple hundred lines of code. And I had the owner's brother, who was the programmer, print out the code, and he printed it out. And I sat there watching it. And by my second night, I was engraving my name on scrap parts, right, on the Haas.
Yeah.
And just one thing led to the other. And then, long story short, I ended up running that shop, the machining side of it, for 6 or 7 years. Progressed on to operations manager and programmer. And I just loved it. Never finished an engineering degree. I took all my units and packed them up into a business degree. But I just found out this is where I want to be because it was exactly what was in my head. I had never seen a CNC machine until the time I was actually, how did I end up there? Keith Peterson, I was in his parking lot because a friend of mine, Adam Young, had a Suzuki Samurai and he had space at his shop, Cornerstone Machining in San Marcos. And we parked his Suzuki Samurai there. And I showed up with one of those used Japanese engines. I'd buy them for $300 a pop and drop them into people's cars. So I went over to his work and dropped the engine in. Maybe it was just a head, but into that motor at his business. And when I was also going to school full time, and I walked into the shop and I saw those machines. I'm like, oh, this is the coolest thing ever. Yeah. And within days, I had this teacher say, quit your job, go work in someplace where there's engineers. I had just met this guy who was doing just that. That's awesome. Within a week, I had quit my job at payphones and got a job at the machine shop. Within a week after that, I was hand programming parts. The owner, yeah, Keith Peterson, and his brother, Kevin, really just terrific guys. Just, they don't get any better. They, oddly enough, took off for a week or two, I think 2 weeks, to take a service training class at Haas Automation up in Oxnard. So this is San Diego.
Yeah.
And they went up for a training class for 2 weeks, and we all got left there. And the main focus of this business was actually golf putters. We were making golf putters for Scotty Cameron by Titleist, you know,
okay,
or Odyssey, White Hots, and that kind of stuff, Newport 2s, these golf putters. But
that's cool.
They were gone for 2 weeks, and I was a button pusher. And while they were gone, somebody walked in the front door from Sound Image. They make large industrial sound devices for like stadiums, that type of stuff. Okay. And they had these panels that needed to be engraved. And I just happened to be up front using the restroom. And they came in and no one's there. And I said, oh, here you go. I'm like, okay, great, whatever. And I bid the job right there, right there, took it back. Tony was my supervisor. And he said, why aren't you at your machine? I said, oh, I'm making these parts. Didn't say anything. And I went and machined these parts out, and I scrapped them. So now I've got these scrap plates that I scrap on the engraving on them, but I didn't make the plates. I just was supposed to engrave these plates that had already been lasered out or whatever. And so then I had to call the customer. So I called the customer up and said, hey, I scrapped this plate. You gave us a week, this thing's done. I'm just letting you know. I said, I'm going to replace the plates, obviously, but it's, you know, is that a problem? Is there any finish requirements? Anything? He's like, no, just whatever. Just get the plates done. And so I drove to Industrial Metal Supply, right, and got some more plate. Now I had to make the plates. So then I had to cut up the plates, then re-engrave it. I got them to the customer. I got them to the customer in like 2 days. And he said, great. And he gave me a bunch of more work. And so by the time that the owner came back after 2 weeks, I had already taken two or three jobs and lost $200 of my own money replacing this material. And without a word being said, I just kind of morphed into this other programming job. And he had at first told me that there were no programming jobs available. I mean, his brother was a good programmer. They didn't need a programmer.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean there's not a programming job available. I mean, everyone wants to duplicate themselves, copy themselves. Yeah. And while they were saying no, they were showing me the CAM system at the time. And so we just kept going. And one thing led to another. And then I started doing a lot more turning work on their big bore lathes and more mill work. And then it turned from golf into a lot of biomedical and doing a lot of engine work, that type of stuff. Okay. And that turned into a lot of race work for a company called Daily Engineering, oil pans, NASCAR, stuff like that. Which eventually led to a phone call from friends of mine in Detroit. They said, hey, you want to come out here and make some parts for us? And so that was cylinder heads and engine blocks and RHS race blocks turned into. I was able to get my hands on some NASCAR blocks and poke some holes in those.
That's so cool.
Yeah, but I've always been really fortunate to be around some really good people. And, a lot of those relationships come back and back, right? You get these phone calls years later.
Yeah, so cool. Give me, if you're okay, give me a rough year that the year you went and put the cylinder head or engine in the Samurai.
97 or 98, I started machining there. And then, so I did that and stuck around there. So then I ended up dropping out of school, finished school eventually. But I ran that shop for 6 or 7 years. Went to work for another company called Giant A&M. They made junk, like the trash that you put on cars from the car dealership. I was making molds for hitch covers, and I was making molds for floor mats. So, like if you had a Freightliner truck, I would make a Freightliner format with the dealer's logo in it. So I'd make these master molds, yeah, and then those and hitch covers. And we weld up bow tie or oval.
Yeah, I've done that.
Selling those with the dealer's logo on them. Mm-hmm. So everything we did was that we would radio frequency weld carpeted floor mats, the heel pads, and I'd make dies for that.
That's super.
So we did a lot of that for a few years. That took me to Nebraska, where we moved a facility from California to Nebraska. And then that's when I got a phone call from my this friend of mine, Devin Rickey, who was working at Siltech, PowerTech Engineering in Detroit, making race car stuff. But he had always made race car stuff. He still does. But he was he had worked at McLaren and his boss, Leo, he was the head of Mopar for a while. Kind of was that whole Fiat Chrysler switchover. So he was, he was all involved in that. So he was running the Mopar side of things. And so he was working with the Dodge Viper team. And so when they ran like 24 hours of Le Mans, he was in charge of that entire program for engine development. And so I did a lot of work for them when I was in California on their Viper project. And so I ended up going back to Detroit and doing more Chrysler and Ford work on the same type of thing, aero racing, yeah, and just sure, punching holes. Same exact thing as always, except now I was doing it in castings instead of
pillars. Yeah. Yeah. That's fun. Let's talk about software. So you said that original owner started showing you their CAM system.
Wow. So Autodesk, they have AutoCAD. Remember the black screen, like the old AutoCAD.
Yeah.
So at the time,
I don't tell a lot of people, sorry to interrupt, I have never used AutoCAD. A lot of people assume I have because I worked at Autodesk. So keep going.
That first software that I was using was TechSoft. So it looked like AutoCAD, but it wasn't. So it was TechSoft CAM, CAD CAM or something like that.
It was called TechSoft Systems CAD CAM programming. Got it right there. It's right there.
What does that say? That was from
says TechSoft. It was like
your instructions and you received.
That was like, I just found this thing. I mean, it's silly, right? But it was 2000. I took it. I tell my story someday, but I took a CAM class, and I haven't heard the word TechSoft in a long damn time. I got excited. So sorry to cut you off.
That's
what they were using.
So they were using that, but then we had the 2D version and then we had a 3D version. So for the golf putter stuff, it was that way. So we would just, create a loft and surface, 2D engraving, Scotty Cameron by Titleist, project it onto the surface and engrave it. So we did tons of that, ended up moving away from that, using Esprit for a while for different reasons. Ended up going with MasterCAM for some different reasons. TechSoft was also part of basically SolidWorks CAM, so it was CAMWorks. So I used CAMWorks for quite a bit there, but then eventually MasterCAM and then the Autodesk stuff. Played around, but now for the longest time, I was buying software not for what I was using, but for my replacement. So I knew that if I'm setting up a facility in Nebraska, that I was only going to be there for a few years. And so I was kind of buying software for the next guy. And so I've used, the MasterCAM and, Hypermill more lately, this type of stuff. Fusion 360 now has been huge, along with the MasterCAM. So it's been this really broad spectrum of CAM software, and I'm no good at any of them anymore. Where it used to be the only thing I did all day long was you live in a CAM software. Yeah. Now I pull it out when I need to make a fart and we'll figure it out. Or I'll call someone like you and ask for help.
Yeah. So now that I'm at Toolpath, and you poked at Toolpath a bit last year before the HTEC conference, right?
Yeah, it was amazing.
And it wasn't very amazing back then. It's gotten better. We'll have to poke at it together at some point. But what I was going to say was, now my role at Toolpath, I'm not the expert anymore, and it is not very comfortable, Mark. I always used it as like a comfort blanket. Well, at least I'm really good at my cam or whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, now I have to be more business focused. So there's people on my team that are quite a bit stronger at it than I am. They just intuitively know where things are, where I have to remember where things are. We're developing so fast that, you know, if I don't poke at it for 2 weeks, I got to go, you know, remember where the new functionality is. So it's different roles. Yeah, it's definitely different roles. I think we're very similar count of cam software. But I think we're both very similar vintage, so that makes sense. Any of the younger machinists listening, I think there's a thread that I think is important there, is that I think you've had a pretty fun career, if nothing else, as have I. I've had a lot of opportunities come my way. And I think a big part of it is because I've been willing to, like, you know, tool's just a tool, right? Where I suspect you've run into people that also were like, no, I'm just a Fusion person, or I'm just a X brand person. I love
rats. Also, if you're at a prototype level, not even prototype level, if you're not doing that much work, you can choose any software, get good enough at it, and it'll serve you for the rest of your life. And there's a lot of shops that do that, and they never change. I ended up going higher and higher production. So I would switch cam systems professionally every couple of years because somebody would come out with a better whatever. So one company would come out with a rest machining. So if I'm cutting big molds, I can't follow up a big end mill with a small end mill automatically. I have to create my own tool pass to do that. So if you have a cam system that can do that automatically, I'm done. I have to switch because I'm spending half my day creating these little tiny contoured tool paths to get in the corners. This is ridiculous. Everyone's going to hear this and think, what? You had to do that? No. Half of my day was spent creating tiny little corner tool paths so I could follow up with a small tool instead of the big tool to save time. Or you could just do the entire thing with a small tool, and then it would take a year to machine this thing. So you buy cam software just for that purpose. And then if you have the adaptive dynamic that changed everything, there's another reason to buy it. And then a few years later, everyone's talking about, you know, barrel cutters, right? Circle segment cutters. So there's certain cam systems that owned that intellectual property. They're the first out of the gate. And so we would buy that software because if you're porting cylinder heads, then it matters. You can save half your cycle time. And then 2 years later, everyone's got the same stop and you can switch back. But if you're doing that type of part nonstop, sometimes you end up being forced to buy that software for a specific purpose. And then it's terrible. You might end up using an old piece of software for 80% of a part, and then this new piece of the software for 20% of the part. But they just keep coming out with these time-saving devices, and you can't ignore them.
You can't. I would say I think I've used 7 cam systems in industry before I banged around with a few at Autodesk. I would say your switches sounded more proactive and mindful. Mine were more like shop over there is running an Integrex, or this shop over here is running a 5-axis. Like I want to go work there, and I'll learn whatever I got to learn to learn that machine. Right. And it was like the cam kind of came with the shop. But the main takeaway for me is that, you know, I had a really fun time being at Autodesk, building this cool community around Fusion. And like, I was with a guy that literally tattooed it on his forearm. Yeah. And I still say, like, just keep an open mind. I have personal friends that have turned down really good opportunities because they didn't want to go be a just Mastercam person. Right. And I was like, no, don't do that. Like, you could have learned this whole other area of machining. So that's my, any young machine or any machinist listening, you know, look at all these tools as just tools to help you be more productive. So that's awesome. What else do we have here? So this is a fun one. If you could go back and give yourself one piece of advice when you're starting machinist, what would it be? Nothing like the old, I don't know. I didn't write down who asked that question, but It is a decent one.
Sure. Well, I knew this when I was younger anyhow, but there's different things you can do to get rich, right? And there's different things you can do to have a better life for yourself. So we all make different choices for different reasons. But if it's easier to skim off the top to make a little something on every dollar the company makes if you own the company. And so working for Haas, and, you know, Haas typically, there are companies like Protolabs and others that have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Haas machines lined up. But there are also thousands of customers that have two machines. And there's a lot of people that are just, they have a friend of their father's who makes a certain part and they need it made. And they're insane and they go buy a machine and they don't know how to machine. They don't know what they're doing. And they bought a machine and I've been into their shops, right? We all have. And they're suffering and it's been a month and they're going to go bankrupt if they don't make these parts. And you help them get them going and they smile, they're happy, they're making parts. And that's at the end of a month. And yeah. I know those guys, 10 years later, where are they? Now they're shop owners and they probably have a dozen machines or a dozen employees or whatever. Or they're happy with just themselves. And they're able to skim off the top because they're getting the top end, right, instead of the back end. So being self-employed is always a fantastic thing. But there are certain things, like myself, I thought about it, started my own shop. There was a lot of different reasons why I didn't. And I'm completely happy not for different reasons to start my own shop. But if you think you might have that inkling, man, go for it.
Yeah, that's good advice. I had my own business where I did like contract work for a lot of different shops. I was chasing the knowledge and the experience at the time. I thought about starting my own shop several times, had an opportunity to partner with a few people several times. And for whatever reason, I just didn't have the balls. Now, like you, I'm beyond happy with where I am, where my life's taken me and all that stuff. I was at a friend Dennis's shop up in Idaho, a month ago. And the whole time I'm walking around, like, it takes a special person. You know, he's got a very impressive shop. And the whole time I'm like, it just takes a special person to not drop dead with a heart attack. I'm just thinking of he shared how much he pays every 2 weeks for payroll. And, you know, he shared some of the finance stuff. He's got a huge, massive five axis machines, like you're just tripping on them all over his shop. And all I see is like overhead. I'm not a regretful person, but there's times I'm like, I wish I would have started a shop. And then I go hang out with people like Dennis up in Idaho. And I'm like, I don't know if I have that. I love where I'm at, but that's a good advice. So, now I want to talk about, mentorship. I'll just cluster together with like mentorship and education. So I think a lot of what you're doing is like one to many mentorship type stuff, with what you're doing at Haas. I try to think I do similarly. I also, you probably also do it. I mean, there is, let me see if I can find the name quickly, but, By the Bay Witch, something like that. He messaged me on Instagram and said, Mark has helped me so much, so many times over the years. Can't wait to hear this episode. So there wasn't really a question there, but, I bring that up because I imagine you also have mentored people. I don't do really many official mentorships, but there's all these like little micro mentorships. Maybe talk about some of the important mentorships with you coming into, I think you may have kind of already talked about some of them, right? But yeah. Maybe some important times and then how you see it with the industry and what trends that you've seen change. I don't know. Go freestyle. Yeah, or tell me to sharpen up the question.
Well, Keith Peterson, his father would run through the shop and he was older, retired, tool and die maker type guy. And he would just look over your shoulder as you were making something, just shake his head, right? Just whatever. And you're like, oh man, what did I do wrong? You figure it out. And if you don't have somebody like that, how would you know that you're just approaching things the wrong way year after year? So it helps. In some weird way, like you were talking about with the YouTube thing, there's kind of like different types of shepherds. There's the flock shepherds and the sheep shepherds, right? Oh. You know, and for this time of my life especially, I'm able to be a flock type shepherd, where I'm able to spend my efforts on the most bang for the bucks. And so last year I did a lot of speaking engagements, a lot of schools and this type of thing. It was an unusual year, and mm-hmm. it was fantastic. And there are real people there. And you know this when you go and you talk to these educators, that they are essentially sheep shepherds. They're talking with somebody in their life and they're pouring into an individual that's sitting in a seat in their classroom, and they're impacting them. And that's absolutely necessary. The sheer volume of views that might exist, or if you make a good video and just answer the question once, right? So I used to answer phone calls, and I would answer a question. Here's the answer, click. Here's the answer, click. Eventually, I'm like, hey, why don't I write this down, right? And the same email. So you just write one really good answer. And then now when you get that question, you just send off the same email over and over again. And the videos give us that opportunity to spend more time than anyone would think reasonable.
Yeah, yeah.
On an answer, and then you can turn an hour long video into a 6 minute video and get them, because that's the way it works. If you spend the answer to all these same questions, and you can make an hour long video right now. They can roll the camera. You can make an hour long video, post the video. It would get information across. Now, if you wanted to get that same information across in 10 minutes, it would take you all week or 2 weeks to get that down. And then you'd have to find somebody to do some graphics, right? Because otherwise it's all whiteboard and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, right now, my biggest mentoring opportunity, I think, has definitely been the wider audience. Because I know how hard it is. I've been there at 2 a.m. when the parts are due, right? And Honda's on the line, and they need those cylinder heads tomorrow morning, and they just have to have them, right? Or Ford, right? They got this whatever. These 5.0 heads have to be done, and you got to get them done. So if you can't get the machine to do what you want it to, and it's especially on a weekend or something like that, it's rough. It's really rough. And so I take this great joy in being able to make a little video that might someday pop up on someone's screen at 2 a.m. on a Saturday. And help somebody out. And it's great.
Good. I like to think more people like us are sharing that stuff and having a real impact in people's lives. A couple things that came up there for me was the first one was Carl Bass. And Carl Bass was the retired CEO of Autodesk, and he's the one that decided to get Autodesk into the manufacturing industry. He brought up just-in-time learning. Is like this concept to me, right? I don't think he invented it. I since, researched it, and it's a thing. But I think that's the world we're in. We talked about it earlier with everything I need to know is basically in my pocket, right? I still answer tons of questions from friends and Instagram friends and all that. And I can't tell you how many times I've been like, oh, I could type this for the next 20 minutes and have a very incoherent, garbage. Or I remember watching Mark talk about this. So I can't even begin to tell you how many times I've forwarded, or John or anybody at the, doing the Great Haas content. So kudos to everyone there. You said something that struck me, and it's a good friend of mine. I was in the military. He's a pretty awesome guy that was in the military, and we were talking about time it takes to prep for things, right? And I was like, man, the amount of time it takes me to prep for a good presentation is insane. And he said, he's like, oh, I got this recipe. If you want me to talk about something and I've got an hour to talk about it, I can start right now. Like I am an expert at what I do. I can just talk right now. And then he's like, if you need that to be 10 minutes, I need a week to prep for it. And he's like, if you need it to be 1 minute, I need a month to prep for it. And At first, well, we may have been drinking. So at first I thought I just wasn't following or something. And he's like, no, I think about it, because the person still needs to know all the critical key information. And he's like, it takes a ton of time to take everything you need to know in that hour and boil it down to what you have to know in 10 minutes. And if you need to know in a minute, you know, it's like, oh, that's a very, very interesting, you know, perspective. And I think you kind of just hit on the same thing. So that's me basically saying you're right.
Well, sometimes that's all you need, right? You can watch a 5-minute video or a 15-minute video and you get the gist of it. You think, oh, I know. And you might not know everything, but you do, you might know enough to get you through, you know, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, to the next step. Yeah. Okay, education. So what has your role been at Haas with education?
So I'm so fortunate in my position and where I've been at. So I work for Haas Automation. We make machines and we have Haas tooling. So we've got all these different types of equipment, right? So now we've got fiber lasers, you know, production equipment like that, and bandsaws and all kinds of stuff on top of the CNC mills and lathes. Gene Haas took some of that money and dropped it into the Gene Haas Foundation. And that money grows and grows and grows. And so then the Gene Haas Foundation takes that money and hands it out for different scholarships and events and robotics teams and Formula SAE college teams or who knows what. So they've got on top of food kitchens and what else. So the education side of that, I've been able to get involved with some of the schools. So I'll answer emails for them. I've gone and done the conferences with some of those guys. But a lot of the teachers that are teaching those classes, I'm now connected with. And so corresponding with, so whatever I can do to help get them going. So there's this real education side as it relates to the Gene Haas Foundation, which is separate from Haas Automation, but it's all manufacturing. It's all, we're all connected in some weird way. Also that, and the first robotics stuff, my daughter was in it. My son's in it, was in it. Now he's in university, but, so I still mentor teams. And so, you know, a couple nights a week, I'm out there, and during build season, I'm there all week. Just having fun. It's a blast because you're seeing these kids who have never picked up a cordless drill in their life, and then they're doing it. And then within a couple of weeks, they're programming the CNC to drill those holes for them. And it's like, what? You know, they just type in an X, Y number. And they, all these kids just seem so much smarter than I was. But they can just pick it up like nothing, and they're getting it done. And they're going to go off and run machine shops or become engineers or designers, or who knows what. But it's kind of fun being there when that light turns on. So I really enjoy that side of things. Plus, it helps me with my day job, right? Because when if there's some student that's in front of a machine saying, what? This doesn't make any sense. I'm like, oh, that'd make a good video. Or we have to make sure to get that in there. So it's staying connected in regards to that. So between FIRST Robotics and actually building stuff, and my son and I just built a rocker bogey Mars rover type robot over the last week that he's now using as a platform for his electronics classes. But so mechanically just showing somebody that, and like, here's how the rivet gun works, or here's how to weld this. It's just fun. And I enjoyed that coming to work for Haas, because, you know, if you've been machining for all this time, you got 25 years of experience. If I come home, my wife's not going to ask me how to whatever, you know, what's a tap drill for a quarter of 20. She doesn't care. I mean, she cares about a lot of things. She cares about me.
Yeah.
But I don't get asked questions like that. So it's a lot of fun to be able to help somebody else skip a few rungs on the ladder and get ahead. And so, to the Gene Haas Foundation, it's been really cool to see that grow. And they're giving away like $20 or $30 million a year. It's gotten insane. And so they're growing that. So it's fun to see educators there. The FIRST Robotics stuff, on a more local level for me, with my kids going through the program, is just a blast to see what they're capable of building. And then seeing all those kids that are going through those robotics programs, going off and starting their own business. So many of those kids, are just getting it done.
Yeah, I care a ton about education. I think I care so much. I mean, I can say I'm a caring person, but like, I think the reason I have cared so much is because manufacturing's given me more than I ever, I definitely on paper, than I've ever deserved. And it's just been a wonderful thing. Somebody took time to encourage me. I when I got into that little plaque thing I showed you when I was in that class, I had a knack for it. You know, I had a 4-year metal shop kid in high school, and nobody ever talked to me about manufacturing as a career path in high school. Even though like I taught my metal shop teacher how to TIG weld. And then, so when I finally got over to community college, I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. That also sounds like a parallel, right? And my machine shop teacher was like, why do you want to be an engineer? Do you really enjoy sitting and doing math all day? Yeah. And he basically was like, go explore being a machinist. And he's like, that guy in the back that you're helping every night, he works at a shop. He could probably get you an interview. And he was like, go talk to them about how much, you know, your earning potential and all that stuff. And I just remember being like, well, I get paid this much to go be a machinist. And so I, it is a very touching thing to me. So I do what I can to work with my local high schools to kind of feed that fire in the young people. Every young person that I have any exposure to is probably sick of me trying to pimp them into the machining industry. But, yeah, I think we share that. My last job I had at Autodesk was an education team, and we've done some videos together that were related to that. And I think it's really important that, you know, kind of the old, I think we're becoming the old guard of the industry, and I think it's important that we stay connected to the education. If any educators are listening and you don't know about the Gene Haas Foundation or the H-Tech community, I imagine Google is pretty good at helping, you know, getting you connected with that. And there's a ton of opportunities there to build a community. I think that the schools that I know that are doing the best in education are the ones that kind of find a good community to support them, help them understand how to get grants, how to convince their principals to invest in programs, stuff like that. So shout out to all that.
The education side here, we have so many opportunities that we just don't realize we have. I was talking to one of our dealers from India, and I was talking about operators. And so these machines are expensive, right? So our machines cost, you know, 40, 50 grand or 400 grand. It depends on what you're getting. And so you have these really expensive machines overseas, and there are caste systems in some ways. It's like, if you're not going to run one of these machines in certain spots in the world without an engineering degree, I mean, there's so many people, you literally have to have a degree to even be an operator in some of these areas, which is astounding. It blows me away. Where here, where we live, you can start at a shop being the deburr guy and learn the whole process, and then find yourself as a supervisor or a CNC programmer and learn the skills, and that's all that matters. Can you make the part? And when things are, there's not a lot of us, right? So there's this imbalance here where the entire chemistry falls apart without the catalyst. And those machinists are the catalyst. If there's not enough of us, nothing else happens. The whole reaction just stops happening. So there's all these opportunities for us that you can work your way from here to here to here to here. And, you know, improve your circumstances that you just can't do a lot of other places. So, anyhow, you can start your own shop, you can become a CNC programmer. And like, even with me, I was told no. I was told there are no CNC programmer jobs. You are wasting your time.
Yeah.
And then I was a programmer there for 6 years.
Similarly to me, I went from that teacher telling me to go talk to Mike in the back, and he got me an interview. I started, you know, one step above sweeping the floor. And within just a few months, I had like leapfrogged past a bunch of people that had been there for years and years and years. And it was because the owner saw me taking, you know, manuals home. Like, I didn't know what I was going to learn in these manuals, but it's a big book. I must have something good to learn. And he was like, I've never seen people take machine manuals home at night. I think the summary of what I tell people is I haven't seen, and I've also been involved in some other industries, but I've never seen people's success so directly connected to their ambition, and their work ethic and their like enthusiasm as I have in machining specifically. I think you could probably find some of that in like coding type things where like, what, show me what you do more than tell me what you can do kind of stuff matters. But I, you know, and that's the other interesting thing for me is like, if your ambition is to just go punch in and out every day and change parts every day, there's this very respectable living doing that. That's not insanely stressful. And if you want to take on all the stress of learning new things and doing all that, like, I mean, I don't belong where I'm at now, you know, as a leader of some software company,
I'm not a good evangelist for the industry that I could be, and that there are so many opportunities out there. I'm like, whatever floats your boat, whatever you just can't stop yourself from doing, go do that. And so I just couldn't stop making stuff. And it got to the fabrication point, and then it got to the CNC programming part where I'm like, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. And if that switch is flipped in your brain, then man, go for it, because you're going to be good at that. And there is an opportunity to make money doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What do I also have to talk about? So we have some Haas topics we can talk about, industry topics. Let's go. Personal favorite Haas machine. Let's make it a quick fire. Mine's the DM series.
I should be that. It's a sewing machine. It's a very fast machine. They just bumped up the accelerations of that machine. It's pretty good. Oddly enough, I think that would probably be one of my favorite. VF2 is still kind of my favorite. It's most people buy VF2. I've spent a long time running VF6s, VF4s, VF whatever. And, these great big giant machines. And I've ran, 630 millimeter, 1,000 millimeter horizontal machines. And they're big. Takes a lot of effort to load them. A VF2 is just a nice human-sized machine. If your parts fit, it's just such a comfortable machine to run all day long.
I have one in my garage, and I absolutely love it. That was like the VF2 SS. That's like too easy. Like it probably is. I mean, it's definitely the most recognizable Haas machine, right?
Yeah.
I think the one that probably surprised me the most was I did a demo on I think it was just a DM1, and it was like, holy crap, this is a really, really just nice machine.
Yeah. Are there new tool paths today? Even with the smaller, like, they have a 30 taper spindle. It's whatever. You get the RPM, you just go to town with those adaptive dynamic tool paths.
What's the Cat 40? Is that the DM?
Probably DM. DM's the same thing. So the DM, they have a DC or whatever. So they have a
DT, yeah.
The DMs at 40 taper. Now we have the new DCs, which is like a ET30 style tool changer that pops out.
Oh, got it. I did see that.
Okay. Machines, yeah.
Okay. The DTs are fine. The DMs just kind of tickled a little something for me. I would give a shout out to the UMC. I think it's a very fine machine. I think what it did for the industry is probably the more important part of it. I remember, let's say 2011-ish, 2012-ish at West Tech. First UMC 750 I saw, when it had like the DMU toilet bowl style trunnion, like the single-sided. I remember I just ordered a $130,000 VM3. That was going to be delivered in a week or two. And I remember walking in and being like, holy crap, the industry just changed. I mean, it changed the industry, period. Like, done, full stop.
That's a nice point. Now there's so many of them out there. And it depends on what parts you're making, but people are making a lot of parts. I remember 2016, the line was making, five a week, and then it was 10 a week, then 20. It just kept growing and growing and growing at that price point. It's just slow. Right.
Yeah.
For that type of manufacturing.
Yeah. Any fun things happening with Haas? Yeah, let's like with Haas, like tech wise that you can talk about.
Where are we at? So we're in the middle of March. Oh, here you go. Huge. Yeah. This is the biggest news to come across Haas in a decade. You heard it here first.
Let's do it.
April 1st. It's not an April Fool's joke. It's legit.
Oh, this will be coming out right after April 1st. Perfect.
I think that right around that time, every single Haas machine is coming with a built-in cell phone charger.
Oh, perfect.
Every single machine built right in, you'll be able to like charge it. I'm not sure if it's like is that Qi charger? What's QI? Is that pronounced Qi? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Oh, you're out of mind.
The wireless charging system. So it's going to be built into the last machines now, standard. Lots of little things like that that are fun.
That'll
and of
be
course,
an interesting one. That will have some opinions, some differing opinions.
I know.
I love it. Perfect.
That's a big one. They're going with a wider screen now, so they're going with the 19-inch monitor, so that's going to change here with the carbon fiber look of the machines. A little change like that.
Tell me about the carbon fiber. I told someone like I knew, but I realized I was probably making it up. I thought that was for the SS machines. Is that not just for the SS?
I think it's going standard across all the platforms.
Okay.
Yeah, I think for most of them,
it feels very SS-y. I would have voted to keep it to the SS line.
No, exactly. It may be, but it's coming across. Well, that's kind of Haas's strong point. The unsung heroes of Haas are the buyers. Because somebody had the idea of like, okay, let's, how much does this thing cost? Everything on the Haas machine, if it functions out of plastic, then we're making that out of plastic or aluminum or stainless or carbon fiber. So somebody found out, like, wait a second, the price of carbon fiber, legit, not a wrap. Carbon fiber has gone way, way down. We can actually get this thing for the same price as something else. So they're just switching it to carbon fiber because it's going to hold up.
The conversation I had was somebody was trash talking these stupid fake carbon fiber things that Haas was doing. I'm like, no, it's real. I checked
it's
it out.
It's actual carbon fiber.
Yeah, I guess that's real. Because I also don't appreciate like the mold in plastic or wrap stuff. And I was like, no, it's real. I assume it's going to stay real. But the machines, yep. I almost stopped when I was walking to the toolpath booth at IMTS. I was like, all right, I got to check that out. So I was happy that it was real carbon fiber. All right, quick fire.
They changed with that. There's, you know, the UMC, like they've got, you're talking about toolpath, right? And so you've got this AI side of things, but you know, even the broken tool detection right now. So it's using vision systems on the UMC for checking that. But that's just one of those things that's not going to go away. It's going to grow. And so if we're using vision systems to check for broken tools, well, at what point you're going to be able to do lots of different things.
Did I miss an update that I tell
you
about?
So the UMCs, so there's an actual vision system on the tool change carousel camera and a vision system. So as it does the tool change, it checks the light offset that's in the offset table. So we're not talking about probing the tool. We can always probe the tool. We've had that forever. And on lathes, it's great to come in and you put on this G212 or whatever, and it touches off the tool. And if it's not within the tolerance, it alarms out or does whatever. So we have ATM, advanced tool management that goes to a backup tool or whatever. But so on the UMC right now, I think on some of the larger machines, we have this vision system that's been out for a year now. And it's continuing to be rolled out and continuing to be refined. And so it's that the control automatically looks at the system and says, hey, this is a chipped insert or it broke the drill. Don't run the tap.
No kidding.
It's just going to get more and more advanced as the software gets better and better. Just the way everything's going.
I'm familiar with some machines will have like a whisker that really quickly chipped.
Yeah.
I have not heard of that. So I will make sure to check that out. What tools... Yeah, tool strategy. I mean, here's the deal. Like, I was trying to get to. I see a ton of people, doing different things to get to the bottom of pockets, and I'm always like, yeah, modern tools with good tools can helix to the bottom of pocket really fast. I see a lot of people not really utilizing adaptive is becoming pretty standard these days. Is there any of that stuff that you see where you're like, more people should be doing this or this?
We've got a lot of software enhancement requests, even for ourselves, to add stuff. Like everyone used to use like G12, G13, but at the control, just create a circle. But if it's plunging an end mill in, that's bad news. So you have to drill it out or write your own way to helix in. I'd like to see us go more and more that direction, and where even the helix angle, the ramp rate, is called out as an angle instead of a whatever. Because if I just say, okay, this end mill can go 6 degree, you know, helix angle or whatever, linear angle, whatever. That's the CAM systems use it. I'd like to see the tools to find that way, but it changed everything. So in the schools and the machine shops, you'd have to give them buckets of end mills because they were breaking so many end mills, plunging in or wrapping it into the wrong thing. And so everyone, all the schools were using high speed tools because they couldn't afford carbide. Forget about tool life and wear. You just can't afford it when people are breaking them every single day. You've got these carbide tools with the helical ramp ends on tools. And these tools are lasting forever at schools because you just use it every time. Oh, is there a hole there or not? Don't care. You're a student. You're always, whatever it says helical ramps, just say yes. And it ramps in and you're just fine. Makes a big difference. There's lots of little things like that from the tooling side. So many schools are still running dry because they don't want the hassle of running coolant. That bothers me. But whatever. That's fine. I understand why. But then there's lots of tools out there, right? You go with a zero flute, a single flute end mill that can cut dry and not gum up or not load up. There's different things out there that, you know, these high ramp tools. There's always something out there for the schools. And there's on the far side of it, adding more flutes and higher pressure coolant to the production shops.
I feel like fairly recently I've just started seeing more people use like through spindle coolant, high pressure through spindle coolant. That's been nice to see, especially for the drilling type stuff. I imagine you're seeing the same thing.
When I started out, I mean, I didn't have TSC through spindle coolant when I first started out machining. Which it just took forever to drill anything, and then it was just terrifying. And as soon as you go with through spindle coolant, all of your hole drilling problems go away. They just go away. You know, 300 psi if you're going small, you know, smaller tools, then you need like 1,000 PSI or more. But again, now you have this new opportunity where like you can gun drill with a single fluid or a two fluid. You can go whatever. I mean, I've drilled holes in engine blocks, that kind of stuff, you know, 500-600 millimeter, you know, gun drills, just running all the way through because it's like a fencing sword. The things are out there so long, but with the coolant pressure, you can just run through anything. Deep holes.
Let's talk about that real quick. So I've actually been asked, and I kind of make up this like I have a decent feel for answer, but if somebody asks you like what pressure do I need for what size drills, I'm not going to give my misinformation with Mark on the call, but I always say below something you need 1,000 psi. Do you kind of have some general guidelines like that?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I mean, you're fine. I mean, it depends on really what you're doing. If you're actually gun drilling, like really gun drilling, you got a lot of length, you have to push the chips out, no brainer, go 1,000 PSI. And if you're going super tiny, you need even higher than that. But that's very infrequently. I mean, if you're doing a 4 millimeter hole, you know, at 20 inches deep, 1,000 PSI is getting pretty scary. That's getting pretty low. That's your right on the hairy edge. But basically, anything below 3/8 of an inch, you know, 9 millimeter, even 5 millimeter, you want 1,000 psi. Anything above that, really not gaining that much. It's more about the gallons per minute than the psi. And the 300 psi coolant pumps can keep up with that just fine. So small stuff, higher psi.
All right, that's not far off. Is it 3/8 ish under 1/2 inch, I've even said before.
Purpose size, we have charts that show the gallons per minute for the oil size. Okay. Even on the through-spindle coolant pages, you just Google through-spindle coolant versus flow. It's pressure versus flow. We've got all kinds of charts and that's stuff that explain the difference and where you might need one versus the other.
That's great.
Yeah, but it just I broke so many drills, and then you get TSC, and all your problems go away.
Yeah. I also see it overused. I see it used just on everything, and turned into big, fog makers, right? So I think it's easy to, like, when you're a hammer, everything's a nail, fall in that world, right? All right. What do you think about the AI question? So I have just, with AI, automation, all this stuff, it's probably two questions, right? So I work for Toolpath. Like, we're leveraging AI to help people be more productive with their estimating and their CAM programming. We should poke at it soon. You haven't used it in a long time. So we should show it off soon, because I'm super proud of how much we've changed in the 8 or 9 months since I've been here. But I left Autodesk, like, I think one of the better jobs in the industry to come help start Toolpath. Because I think it's a critically important part of our future. And for me, that means, making individual, the people, the bottlenecks of the shop, the guy doing the estimating, the guy doing the programming, to free up those bottlenecks and help them think about tight tolerances and fixturing and, running their business, right? Imagine that. So I guess to me, that also kind of ties with palletizing, automating, things like that. So we can kind of link them together, but
yeah.
How do you see that changing the industry? Like, how much have you seen it change the industry already? And then how do you see that moving forward the next, 3, 5, 10 years, something like that?
I cannot overstate the importance and how big of a deal I think this is. So, a year ago, I was doing some conferences and talking about it. And of course, this is the 2024 thing, right? So we had ChatGPT come out really big in 23, and by 24, it had just changed and changed and changed. It is just clear as day that it is a global shift that's going to be happening here. So I just, because I always relate things back to this Industrial Revolution stuff, it's just where my head goes. But when the Henry Ford, he's creating these $950 Model Ts in 1908, he gets them down to $350, within 10 years. How do you go from $950 for a car to $350 per car? Well, it used to take 12 hours to assemble that car, and he got it down to 3 hours to assemble the car, clear as day. And then the price dropped by whatever. So looking at the labor costs involved with a process really relates directly one-to-one with the final cost you can charge for something. You will not be able to compete with somebody selling a $950 car when they're selling the same thing for $350. You will not be able to compete in this industry in 5 years without software that can make use of a more intelligent approach. Now, whether it's really AI or just a really good algorithm, don't care. I just want something that's going to cheat. Like I said earlier, I've switched softwares a half a dozen times, and each time I literally spent $2,000 or $50,000, right, for software to save me a little bit of time. But when that's all you do, if you're a CNC programmer, man, if you can save those minutes every single day, they compound, it's unavoidable. It's going to be the biggest thing to change our industry in my lifetime. I mean, there was a time way back when TSC changed everything, probing changed everything, kind of all these little things. I think all of those are going to be dwarfed by intelligent software just changing the course of our businesses. Yeah, you just can't be overstated.
Yeah, good, because I feel the same as I've shown with my career.
You mentioned Carl Bass. So I've heard the quote, and I've seen it recently, but I also heard it a year ago when I was looking at all this stuff. Yeah, but he's saying, you know, the industry in 5 years, right? Where is it going to be? It clearly, everyone sees the writing on the wall. And we talk about the ChatGPT type of stuff where I was going in there like day one asking it to write G-code programs for me. Wow. And I got those screenshots of the code that it spat out, right? In, you know, November of, you know, whatever, 22. Or then, you know, as soon as it came out there, yeah, you know, all through 23, every couple months, I'd try it again. And yeah, and it would crash my machine, you know, at the beginning of 2023. Yeah. I would ask ChatGPT to drill a hole. And by the end of 23, not only could I ask it to drill and tap, but it would tap and it would calculate the feeds and speeds for my tap properly. And then I started asking it to create a pocket for me. And it was great. This is just ChatGPT, let alone a custom solution that is bespoke and actually made for a specific, you know, software integration. Yeah, it's going to be the defining question. So the defining question 5 years ago with a CAM system, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, do you have adaptive machining? Blah, blah, yeah, blah. Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, are you going into the corners? Or are you just making these constant chip load, you know, volume mill style adaptive dynamic tool pass? And it became the question. If your CAM system doesn't have that, you should not buy that CAM system. You have no business getting into a piece of software that doesn't have that style tool path. It's just sometimes you just need it. And we're going to be in that same spot absolutely in 5 years, maybe in a year. We just don't know that if your software can't make use of whatever, some AI-influenced tool pass, it's just not going to be competitive anymore. It's going to lose that competitive advantage.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what I'd say. I definitely bet my career on it. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to I think to think through it live, right? So I started writing G-code in 99. And CAM was definitely around. Lots of shops were using it, but also lots of shops were just 100% G-code.
Yeah.
And then it was like there's a point where like almost no shops are 100% G-code. And then I was 16, 17 years ago almost that I bought the productivity package for MasterCAM, which brought dynamic milling in. Funny history lesson. The people that started HSM made that plugin for MasterCAM, who ended up being Fusion, right? And I remember I was doing work for a customer and I was like, look, I just took this hour and 40 minute roughing cycle down to 45 minutes. And I think your tools are going to last longer. You know, it was like, what?
It got rid of the lowest common denominator. You had to slow down an entire roughing operation
exactly
for that one corner, unless you wanted to create 100 different things or who knows what. And now it's just, you find the ideal speed and feed for that tool, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the geometry.
You just never let it disrespect it. Yeah. So I think of that. I that was a very known common thing by the time I started at Autodesk in 2015, 10 years ago. But then I remember running around being like, "Oh, I'm having to educate people on adaptive milling." And then at Autodesk, we were a big part of, we had these Don't Fear 5-axis campaigns and like, you know, it's not scary, right? So then it was fun for me to see people think about, you know, even just prismatic parts differently instead of like buy a machine, put a person in front of it, buy a machine, put a person in front of it. I think it was really like, oh, wait, I can do this thing in one or two operations. So that was like a big milestone for me. And then I think Haas has done an excellent job of just making things more accessible, right? And I think Autodesk did a really good job making, you know, technology more accessible. It was before I joined Toolpath, I was thinking, what's the next thing? Is it B-axis, you know, mill turn lathes? You know, is it this, that? And that's when I got into Toolpath and was like, oh, this is... If we do it right, you know, this is the thing that hopefully will change everybody's lives. Okay. What's the biggest, I can't believe I just saw that moment. I can tell you mine, but we don't. It's not about me. But there was a
moment. You got to throw it back.
I was in the bike industry. It was the second. I can tell you the second that I was like, oh, my life just changed. I'm going to be a machinist. I raced mountain bikes. I was a World Cup mechanic for one of the best women that ever raced mountain bikes. And I was at Intense Bicycles down in Lake Elsinore, something like that, down in Southern California. And I walked into their machine shop because I was supposed to be meeting the owner, but he was busy. I've already told the story a bunch of times. But then I remember I went back and I saw they were machining dropouts or yokes for swing arms on a Haas EC400. Not as nice. The new EC400 is pretty nice. That one wasn't very nice. But they were just machine. They're just making magic inside this machine. And I just remember being like, holy shit, my life just changed. My life literally just changed. And I went to Europe after that. And all I could think about. And if I had a phone at the time, that's all I would have done the whole time I was there. But I don't know. That was, like, by far, no question, the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. Like, this is the day my life just changed. So you're not going to beat that, but
there's a moment right there. It was funny for me in that I had already kind of taken this job at the machine shop before I fully understood. I mean, I thought, this is cool. This is really cool. But for the most part, that shop was doing we did a lot of die work for like Hunter sprinkler heads, Bluebird, that kind of stuff. So a lot of EDM work, electrodes, that kind of stuff, and a lot of golf work. It was primarily an industrial engraving house. So I can't tell you how many thousands of single lip cutters I've ground, right? For whatever. And saw these Deckel, SO grinders. And so it was primarily engraving. And so I started work it there, but they were doing some really cool stuff. So they were doing some mountain bike parts, a lot of race car parts for Nissan, and then eventually for Mopar. And so it took me a few weeks or that first week before I started realizing what these machines could do. Because when I first saw them, I'm like, okay, it's just a giant pantograph machine. That's what they used to do. This guy, he was doing it. And big engraving machines, whoopee, right? It wasn't a big deal. And then they started getting in these different jobs. And then, like, I remember they had these toes and heels for these Odyssey putters, and they were stainless steel and they were drilled and tapped. It just occurred to me, like, that's some gnarly stainless, and they're drilling and tapping it, and I had never seen a thread formed before. And I just, like, that is, and then it clicked. I'm like, I can do anything. Just that simple thing. I'm like, I can do anything. And within months, yeah, we were making yokes for our dune buggies and whatever else. And it was just that's amazing. Cool. And cool. Now with 3D printers and stuff, you can do so much. I think you can get those sparks started earlier with students in the schools. But still, CNC machining, you can just do things you can't do with anything else. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. All right. Well, that's all I had prepared. I'll read down through. So I posted on Instagram, like, hey, meeting with the Mark Terberry. Anybody have any topics or comments? So do you have anything you want to chat about before we wrap up with questions and comments?
So, well, I have some curious questions about toolpaths. So I know Carl Bass, and not know him, no, but I know him. And I know the Autodesk connection like that, and different pieces of software out there. Now there's a handful of companies that are getting into manufacturing in one way or another, trying to solve this Rubik's Cube, to make it further down that line. And I know your background and Al's and group of you from Fusion 360. Yeah. What's the future for toolpath look like as far as the CAM softwares that it's going to be ideally working with? What is the future as far as, well, we mentioned a half a dozen different CAM systems out there. What's the future look like for toolpath?
So there's
use those different tool CAM systems.
Yeah, different CAM systems. And so we're pretty laser focused on Fusion. Yeah. We know the community. Exactly. We know how it builds, you know, all that stuff. We helped build the community. There's lots and lots and lots of, you know, pretty impressive shops using Fusion. We have lots of options, but I think, you know, we're pretty laser focused on like, let's serve that community well first.
Get it.
From there, ModuleWorks, if you're familiar with ModuleWorks,
the back end. They always seem like they were the back end of a lot of different CAM systems. They were the wizard behind the curtain.
And I say they're the giant in the shadows, right? So anybody that's not familiar with ModuleWorks, they're a company over in Europe. They're a toolpath kernel company. If you've used CAM, there's more than 80% chance that you use ModuleWorks toolpaths. They're in Fusion. You know, we licensed it in Fusion to kind of fill gaps between the HSM kernel and the Dell CAM kernel. MasterCAM uses them a ton. I actually can't think of maybe more than one or two CAM companies that don't use them. I don't think CATIA does. So they made a strategic investment in us because they felt like we were doing, you know, we were the ones taking, you know, in the industry where they wanted to go. So we have lots of options. I mean, we're generating their toolpaths in the background. Once we feel like we're credibly doing things that we should be doing with Fusion and we're happy with it, we have like lots of directions we can go. We could expose calculated toolpaths in Fusion or MasterCAM, lots of different things. And to be honest, Mark, like for now, we're focused on getting to that point to where it'll be pretty easy to take a toolpath, and expose that in other CAM systems. And one thing that I've like shared with my team is like, it's important to be agile. Like we're going to plan the next several quarters. We have long-term visions. But things got, you know, the old Mike Tyson, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face. You know, we have a plan. The main first thing that we're pretty laser focused on is deliver, like, you know, I tell everybody like the bamboo printer experience, the Apple experience, you know, that kind of thing with helping people, you know, leverage AI to get, to be grossly more productive. We recently acquired Chatter as a machine connectivity company. We need to deliver on closing a loop where like we did an estimate, we helped you do the estimate. So we told you what you should do. The CAM kind of executes that. And then we should be able to close the loop and tell you what you actually did. Right. And then start, you talked about whether it's AI or not earlier. I'm learning a lot about AI right now, as you can imagine. And so there's like large language model type AI. There's what you'd call like a machine learning type AI. As a principal from Toolpath, we believe it's, we're not looking to scrub the world to learn how to be machinists, right? What we are looking to do is help Mark be more of Mark, you know, our buddy CJ, you know, CJ, like CJ yeah. does very interesting, very specific things. Our role in any shop is like, you know how to do something really well, and we should just help you do that a lot more of it, right? So we're not using people's like data to teach any machine or anything, but our goal is to use our AI engine, which is this really interesting board game kind of thing, for you just to be grossly more productive and be able to make parts the way you want to make parts, and then close the loop to kind of also learn from yourself, right? So we don't have any like real direct plans that are like, after this time we're going to start working with MasterCAM. Yeah. After this time, we're pretty well connected to the industry. I think there's some really interesting things we can do with ModuleWorks once we feel like we're appropriately and properly delivering with Fusion. So it's a great question.
That's amazing.
Answer it good enough?
Yeah, it's terrific. Yeah, and like always, you know, the company will call an audible when the opportunities present themselves. And I'll just, because I'm here and talking about toolpath and AI and this subject, the same thing with all my CAM systems. I would love 100% solution for everything. I would like to walk in and have my entire job done for me and just collect a paycheck. It's not going to happen. But yeah. I tell you, what would you do for 5%? I mean, literally a 5% savings. So when we build engines, right? So you're talking about, you know, F1, you're talking about NASCAR and stuff like that. And I've worked, you know, on NASCAR stuff. Man, yeah. Like those oil pump guys. I remember Daly Engineering, when they were designing those things, I'm not sure if they're still making oil pumps or not. They must be.
They are. Yeah.
And then they were sending out oil pumps to NASCAR teams, right? When they were getting going, 25 years ago. And they were testing these things. They were waiting back. And I'm like, okay, you place this order. And you told me to hold it because I'm making something for them, one little widget. And what's the deal? Like, we don't know. We haven't gotten this confirmation. And the NASCAR teams were leading them on because they would have given it to a couple different teams to try out these certain oil pumps and pans. It's killing them. They're not getting the feedback. And it's a week after week after a week. And then find out that it gave them a 5% horsepower boost, right? And it gave, which gave them a 2 mile an hour better top speed at whatever. Fractions of a fraction. And the teams weren't feeding this back to them because they knew as soon as they did, they'd blow up and they would sell it to all their competitors.
Yeah.
And so these fractions, I mean, I'd be thrilled with a 5% savings in my time for programming a part, let alone 20%. And if it can go through and set up on a prismatic part, my work offsets for me, all that stuff is just money in the bank. If we're quoting a part, I used to quote. So I, I don't know how many thousands of parts I programmed, let alone. So if I programmed just thousands, I mean, it was I probably did 5 parts a day for 7 years.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some of them are more complex and some of them are less complex. I don't know how many that is. It's a lot. Yeah. And that's the ones we got. So how many did we not get that I quoted and just wasted my time?
That's wasted time, right? So I clearly look at to uncover some of the kind of strategy behind it is the abbreviated story is that, you know, when Al and I were looking at Toolpath, they were looking to be a Toolpath automation company, all the way to the code. And we realized like we can add incremental value to a shop as we get more credibly, you know, kind of own that automating Toolpath part of things. And I had seen several shops like 7x their business in 3 years because they started automating their quoting process, right? Even, I mean, I've seen shops grossly improve just from automating in a spreadsheet because they have some kind of, you know, something that makes sense. They have a process. And so we looked like, oh, the technology is really good. And if you're 8% off on an estimate, it's not going to kill you. It's when you're 50% off or 100% off or miss that feature that you just can't even machine. I did like a side job in my garage on my VF2. You know the travels on a VF2. I had a 26-inch plate with a 20 thou hole at the end of the 26 inches.
Oh.
And it looked like that. It looked like a graphical anomaly I didn't actually see it at all. And then until I like committed, I was doing it during the holiday break. It was like a fun project and want to get out in the garage. And I screwed my buddy, you know, who basically called in I got a friend that I'll do this quick part for us during the holiday break and he'll deliver, you know, and they needed it January 2nd and, you know, December 28th or whatever, I realized, oh, I'm screwing my friend. And it was a stupid little hole, you know, just a dumb little hole. And the first part I ran through Toolpath before I started working here was that part. And sure enough, it's red, you know, showed me there's a setup that required over there. It's just a simple drill operation, but I can't do it in my machine. So
we should sell an option for this, by the way. When you jog a tool, you put the drill, people, you know, like let's say your machine has 30 inches of travel, it's a VF, whatever, 25 inches of travel. And you think, oh, I got to drill a 10 inch hole. I got enough travel. I'm like, no, it's because you have the drill sticks out above that by much more. I've seen some crazy stuff from Haas customers, and I've got a folder full of these kind of crazy pictures. Most of the time, if you put a drill, jog all the way back, you're usually, if you jog the table forward, the drill is usually sitting on the table. In other words, you could drill right to the table at the edge of travel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Typically speaking, on most Haas machines, you can jog the table back, and if you were to drill straight down, you still have travel, but you are not on the table.
Yeah.
And so we used to have a drip pan across the front of the machines.
I remember.
And those are gone.
My machine used to have it. I took it off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they're gone. And I've seen several pictures from customers where they have gone through and like just bought a mag-based drill, and they've drilled and tapped into the front of their table, their cast iron table, and they've added clamping systems there, and they are bolting on fixture plates. So they'll put an angle plate on the table, right? So you have an angle plate there, an angle plate here. They've drilled and tapped the face of their table, the mag base and whatever, and they're bolting on these giant plates that are way too tall for the machine, and it works totally fine. They're getting VF4 travels out of a VF2. Because for that operation, that end thing. So you could have done that tap tool on your VF2 if you're willing to do some horrible, horrible.
I don't know if I had enough travel between the weight cover and what ended up happening is I took it over a friend with a horizontal. I knew people. I used to make wing spars for old tailhook, World War II planes. And we made one. Really, really long in a VF2. And we had a automatic clamping thing. It would basically like put it way out one window and out the other window.
Yeah.
And we just wrote a little program to unclamp it. It would come down, grab the part, move it over with the spindle, clamp it, come back. And so the industry is so freaking creative. It's pretty fun.
You never have a big enough machine.
Never.
And you quote the wrong job. I ended up doing jobs mold bases in four ops instead of two because you're flipping and blending on molds. And we got people down in Texas, all the oil work there. They've got these giant oil pipes where they have cut holes in the center block wall next to the leg, and they've got tailstocks going a half a mile. these long pipes, they're just feeding in and recutting threads. And there's some crazy stuff going on there that people just get it done.
Yeah.
It's a fun industry. People often forget that we're machinists. Somehow, when it comes to their own tooling, you make parts for other people. You can make your own fixture.
Yeah, that's something I very often think about with work holding, right? Like so often, like the people buying the work holding from you guys, Fifth Axis, Lang, anybody. I know the guys at Fifth Axis pretty well. And I'm always like, man, you guys gotta... When somebody wants to buy 200 vices, make sure you pick up the phone and talk to them, because if you rub them wrong, don't give them a deal, whatever the deal is, they'll just go make them things themselves. Anyways, so I think we answered the toolpath question. I think, what we were talking about is estimating, right? So, we took this kind of pragmatic approach. Like we can definitely deliver on helping people estimate pretty quick, and get very close to a good estimate, which very close is better than most people in their estimating. My friend up at Hamilton up in Reno, Phil Lynchide, we have him on video saying we're pretty bad. Not Hamilton, but we as humans are kind of bad at just naturally quoting stuff.
He used to be an engineer at Haas.
Oh, that's right. He was a Haas guy. He did a really good episode with Intolerance. It's worth listening to. So anyways, we delivered on that. We still are delivering on that. And now we're shifting our focus back to like getting cam automation more to a finish line. I made this part a few weeks ago. It's not, the most impressive part ever. But I was holding off on like social, we've been making parts for a long time with Toolpath, but I was holding off like socializing it. I wanted to make a nice prismatic part, 100%. And for me, that was a huge milestone. So next are milestones to help people automate, get Toolpaths more to a finish line, help people automate their work holding. That's kind of coming up in some of the next couple sprints. And then before we get to start helping people with multi-axis, that's kind of our thinking with work holding. We don't earn our way to helping people with 3+2 type machining until we can automate their work holding, right? You should be able to say, what's the best, most efficient work holding, or I'll force it to these three things, right? And that's very cumbersome. Yeah, I'm really fast. Yeah, go.
We've been talking about this for years. The last couple of years, you know, obviously AI has been huge, and then, you know, all the Nobel Prize winners, doesn't matter if it was in, basket weaving or physics, everything had something to do with AI, right? Everything was wrapped up with AI over the last year or two, with, you know, Nobel Prizes even. So it's obviously on everyone's mind. Everyone sees the benefit of this. So Haas has this heavy investment going on with AI as well. So we've been working with different companies to help us with our own internals. And so while we were testing this, and while the IT guys and the software engineers were testing this for our own personal uses, they let the AI loose into our own database of, you know, whatever, like a, you know, custom GPT kind of.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, what's the best 5-axis work only for this machine? And it came back. We didn't prompt it. We didn't do anything. And it came back with the right self-centering advice, with a bolt pattern that matched this UMC 750 with everything. I'm like, this was awesome. And this was just a demo. It wasn't even the real thing yet. Yeah. So in the next year, we're hoping to have that, like everyone else, this AI button on the Haas website here, where people can just go on and get recommendations for tooling, get recommendations for, especially for fixture place, you know, that type of thing. A lot of variations with this type of thing. And if you can do that.
I mean, I think about just as a programmer, estimator, whatever, just as the, like, I it's not a hard task for me to go decide which tools I have will fit in these features, but it's fairly time consuming, right? It's not that hard for me to go look through my catalog of devices options that I have and decide what will fit on this part, but it is time. It's somewhat time consuming. And there is like error, you know, associated with that, right? Toolpath's really good at looking at your tools and your tool library and looking at the cutting parameters and picking tools based on like MMR. That's kind of how our AI engine works. Like you get points for this tool is more productive than this tool. But I've done workshop after workshop after workshop teaching people how to leverage 3D models of vices and work holding and put it all together in this big multi-axis assembly. It's all fairly simple. It's just a ton of work. And for a lot of people, it's like a relearn every time they do it because they don't buy a new vice every day, right? So for us, it should be a pretty magical experience, and we should be delivering on it this year. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to see what happens there. It really is this industrial revolution moment where, and we saw it happen when Excel came out. I don't know why YouTube was recommending me a video. It was a commercial for Excel from in 1990. No and it was way. The only pitch this guy makes us. And it's just like, we take it so for granted. But in companies like GM and stuff like that, you know, how many thousands, tens of thousands of accountants did they have? My dad was doing that. He was he did accounting for Peter Kiewit, like a construction company. So he just kept the books. He did all these, you know, that's all he did. I've got these binders of his, and all that stuff is just a QuickBooks type Excel spreadsheet where you can do the work of 20 people and the small change.
Well, just this morning, I wanted to express cusp heights with different step overs and show people how it changed based on the angled surface that you were on. And I grabbed my machinery's handbook and I was like, I couldn't find, you know, first thing I did is Google it to see if there's already something out there. And there's not. It's all across the flat surface. And I wanted to be able to show bull nose versus ball nose and all that. And it was very quick on ChatGPT. I like drew something in Fusion to kind of, and I labeled like, you know, the different inputs with these inputs. I want to drive this. And how would I make this in Google Sheets? And I could have long handed the math, but it was like, boop, 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 boop,
boop. Wow. And it helped you out in Google Sheets.
It's basically copy this, put that in cell D, and then your inputs will be A1 equals, you know, tool radius, A B1 equals the target cusp height that you're trying to get. What I wanted it to do is me put in tool radius, desired cusp height, and then the incline angle. And then tell it what the step over should be, or, you know, step over, step down. And it did. I was like, under 5 minutes, because I had to like, actually, you don't understand. Here's a picture.
So that's when it became real for me. When the whole thing, like, I've got a stack of books behind me that I've read on AI, and they're all useless, right? Because they're a year old. that's like ancient history.
Oh, yeah.
When it became real for me was when my son had a school project that he was working on, and it, he has this like little S7. It's an ESP32 controller. It's like an Arduino. And it's a dial that's electronic, and it's got a little LED or OLED screen in the middle that's round. And he just wanted to program this thing to make it look like a combination lock, you know, 26, 42, 26, and it'll pop open right with a digital signal.
Oh, but that's fine.
He did it. He programmed it, and it was fine, but it just felt terrible. It was just no motion. It didn't go click.
No index.
Yeah. And when he did it, it just said open, close, right? Or give him a number. And so he went on ChatGPT. This was a year ago. And he says, hey, I've got this ESP32 controller with the S whatever round thing. Write me code that'll do this and make it look cool. And, I want haptics. I want it to give me like force feedback because it's got an encoder in there and it's got a motor that could do something.
Yeah.
And then we loaded it up and it goes click, click, click. And you can hear it click. And you can feel it click. That was programmed by ChatGPT. And then when it got to the right combination, it says correct in a little fireworks show, and it pops the signal. We didn't tell it to do any of that. It worked when we did it, but afterwards, it's like it was insane. And I'm like, this is right now today, a year ago, right? That was like it became real for me. I'm like, this is going to change the world.
Yeah, Carl Bass, I did a lot of things with my daughter a little too young. And Carl Bass one time, I was like, somehow he mentioned Arduinos. And I was like, Google, what's an Arduino? And then long story short, I bought a quad ped, like basically a four-legged spider, that had a wood, laser cut wood that my daughter and I could put together. She loved that kind of stuff. And then she was probably like eight. Or something, seven or eight. And I got all the servos and a little, not a Raspberry Pi, an Arduino. I'm not a coder, but I started learning the code. And basically we got this thing where it would squat and stand up. But I was too dumb to make it, you know, like it was a fairly complex thing to get it to walk, right? And we banged on it for a few days and then just we totally scrapped the whole Arduino, you know, experience. And I was thinking recently, like, oh, that would have been a totally different experience with ChatGPT, where we could be like, hey, here's a code we have. All I can do is get the dumb thing to sit and stand. Help me out. So, it's a fun time to be alive. I mean, I just said that to my neighbor who had a triple bypass and heart valve replacement the other day. All right, let's knock out some questions and wrap it up. Does that work for you?
Absolutely.
Okay. What's the coolest project? The hottest tip of the day. Social media. How active are you on social media? Because somebody's basically saying social media has been. You're not super active, right?
I reply to some comments on YouTube when a video is new, this type of thing. I'm really just not active much. I should be more, but it's that same kind of thing where I've got this. I work for Haas. And so even with making parts, I just have not a lot of interest. I can make parts. If I had to make a part right now, I can program a part. Not fantastic. Not like when I was doing it every day, all day. Yeah. But when I'm working for Haas, the questions that I get are more about the like post-processors or code, or how does this work, or how do you help somebody do that? And if the people at Haas don't answer Haas questions, then who's going to? In the same way that if somebody at Toolpath, right, we need somebody at Toolpath to answer Toolpath questions, even though you are more than capable of answering most Haas questions, right? I mean, you definitely, you just can't spend your whole day answering Haas questions. And so I spend my time, oddly enough, becoming more of a hand programmer than a CAM programmer, because those are the questions that I get for Haas. Like, what setting do you do to change this? Today we were talking about, programming on a subspindle and the orientation of the axes and which way do things move and how do you do this? I get these questions that are really hand programmer questions. So I started out programming by hand for 2 weeks in my first machining job. And then I'm like, this. And I switched my CAM system. And then I programmed CAM for 15 years. And then the last 10 years, I'm back to hand programming because I work for Haas. Even now, we have a whole marketing team that does their marketing for Haas. Yeah. I spend my time looking at videos or correcting manuals or stuff like that only someone at Haas can do. And that's just kind of where I spend my efforts and working at. But at the same time, I love talking with customers. I'll go to trade shows or H-Tech events or even this. I get to go to the first robotics competition in Houston. They have their championships in a couple weeks. So I'm really excited to go to there. Oh. I get to talk to a lot of the students. I'll walk through the pits and talk to hundreds and hundreds of students. And you know what's changed in the last 5 years, 10 years? It's the number of CNC machines in schools. Now, whether it's a router table or some full-blown Haas, there are high school machines that have three or four live tool lays and a couple of UMCs, half dozen. Yeah. Insane.
High school,
In high school. It's really changed.
On that, like I went to a high school that was just started as a vocational high school in like very early 70s. And then it's a freaking book. That's where they store their books now. So schools have like just wiped out trade programs. And I would say in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there is a resurgence of it. I hope to see more of it. The question was about social media has changed the machining industry. Kind of how do you see that changing? I'll speak a little bit to. When I started Autodesk a little over 10 years ago, I had a Facebook account so I could share pictures with my mom, my daughter. Like it was literally like just to get my mom and my aunt, you know, sister and stuff from begging me to send them pictures of my daughter. I spent a decent amount of time like looking for problems on the internet or looking to solve problems on the internet. I found just a ton of like, honestly, toxic forums where people are just hating each other. So I don't like to spend time around people that hate me or, you know, I just don't like that kind of people. Right. And then when I started Autodesk, one of my bosses told me, hey, you need to get on social media, you know, and my first job at Autodesk was sales applications. But then I did a ton of demos. I did lots of demos for Haas and HFOs and different companies. Yeah. And he was like, man, you're doing like super cool stuff. We should share it. And so that's where I started One Ear Tim on Instagram. And it's been a really interesting community for me because I used to have a community of machinists, like-minded machinists in Northern California. And it's really just helped me find those people all over the country. I've had people stop me at IMTS and be like, dude, you changed my life. And it sounds like it's hard to even say that out loud, but like similarly to my buddy Joe changed my life because he helped me with this thing that just opened my eyes. Right. I just texted one of our customers last night. Maritool makes a slitting saw tool holder. That's actually the whole everything.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, you just changed my life. Right. So we wouldn't know each other if it wasn't for Instagram. So I hopefully see that it says, how do you see it evolving? And hopefully just there's a happy place. Some of the toxic places, that internet world, I hope kind of disappear, but
there you go. Have your Instagram folks create a handle for me and I'll start up an account and we'll start posting some more stuff there. I do there see quite a bit of fun stuff that I don't post anywhere.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's always cool stuff. And every now and then I'll post something, but not a ton.
There's an interesting thing with social media, right? It's there. There's everybody knows about all the toxic bad things, but in the Insta Machinist community, there's something pretty good. There is like five or six comments in my One Ear Tim, request for questions, where people were asking if, you know, with my hat off, if we were brothers or related somehow. Officially, we are not. Especially when I need glasses as of the last couple of years to see past 20 feet or to see good past 20 feet.
We're looking more and more alike.
Yeah. So at the trade shows, I don't have my hat on. We look more and more alike. What's a common misconception people have about Haas machines that you'd like to clear up? Do we want to address that?
Sure. What's funny about Haas machines, I'm thinking about those new Tesla robots, those Optimus robots. Have you seen those?
Oh, yeah.
Robots? So yeah. I've seen them doing some crazy things, folding laundry and doing mechanical work and stuff like that. And recently, what's funny is you can see the guy in the background who's wearing the haptic suit, who's actually controlling the robot, right?
Oh.
So they're not there yet. They don't have the full AI, Terminator robots yet, but the hardware is all there. Haas machines, we would love for a toolpath. We would love for the CAM systems to just keep going the direction you're going, because you're the brains behind our hardware. You're the person holding the strings with our marionettes. And so as you create this future world for machinists, it helps us quite a bit. We're going to sell 10 times more machines when you guys get that software done. And with that, again, people talk about rigidity of machines. There's different machines. We just came out with them, oddly enough. So just today, I think they were announcing that we got this new SB28 or whatever it is. It's a boxway lathe. So we've got a boxway lathe that we just came out with, which can take a little bit heavier cuts, that type of thing. So generally speaking, the Haas lathes, it's a different style. We keep our RPMs up and we take a lighter cut, more passes, and it's just fine. And it's weird. I ran some other lathes where normally if I get into chatter, my first instinct is always just the lathes that I've ran, I always reduce my RPM, my surface footage, chatter goes away. Something was different. I started running the Haas lathes. Whenever I get into chatter, I've always found better luck on the Haas lathes, bumping my RPMs up. And it helps with the harmonics, and I get through the chatter, and I can rip. And what's funny is like, okay, now I'll just go buy an insert with some better coating that allows me to run at a higher surface push, and now I'm making more money anyhow, so why not? But there's always ways you can get around those things. So one misnomer that we always used to hear was, oh, Haas is only for aluminum. We cut steel all day long. And like you were saying, for the past 10 years, you can cut titanium on a Tormach. With these new tool paths, it's just a matter of what's your metal removal rate, how fast you want to go, what your production is. But it's not a matter of can you. It's a matter of should you, and that comes down to that's a different question. What's your volume of parts, this type of thing. But again, if you looked at our IMTS booth this last year, the entire show was like never before. It's all about robots and pallet loaders and pallet pools. It's all about automation. I got to see, I had a cousin, Rex. He works at the foundry at John Deere factory in Iowa, Waterloo. And when you look at John Deere makes tractors, and you think of John Deere is a technology company now. In the same way that Haas is a technology company, an automation company. If you go to the John Deere website and just type in John Deere technology, it'll say that their goal is to increase the world production of food by 60%, by 2050 when we need it. And that they're going to do that by allowing these machines to plant and harvest food day or night without an operator. And I'm like, wait a second, that sounds familiar. It seems like everything we're doing, there's not enough Tims to program and run all these machines. We can always buy more machines. You can line them up. But now you have to have somebody that can program them. So if you do that, then we get rid of that bottleneck as well. And we can run these machines day and night with the right software. And now if they can load themselves with an operator, and what's funny is all these technologies that we add just makes the operators that do want to go into this industry, people like me and yourself, they're just like, this is so cool. I want to do this. There's more gravy, for us. There's more left on the table for us. We get paid more because we've got more skills. We can do more things. And it's just, It makes it for a funner career, a funner job. You're not just sitting there doing the same thing every day for your entire career.
Yeah, I'll answer. They didn't ask if it was just for me or just for you, but misconception of Haas. So you talked about the rigidity. That's what people bring up. Maybe it had more validity in years past. I brought up the EC400 from 25 years ago. I actually poke at that machine quite a bit because it was literally the machine that like made me sell my soul to industry. And then years later, I was running one. And I think it was one of the first, you know, horizontals they made. It wasn't the best machine they ever made. I jokingly say it was maybe one of the worst. But I went from a machine that's probably five times as expensive. That's what I was running to that. Yeah. I learned how to make good parts on it. And that machine had made that company lots and lots and lots of money. But then I recently, maybe a year ago, cut on the new EC400, and it's mechanically just a grossly different machine. It's the foundation of the machine is more of, I would say there's kind of an accepted good kind of structure of a modern horizontal. And the EC400 looks like that. And I know several happy people running them. So that's, you know, everything's evolved. Toolpath is a lot different company and functionality than it was 6, 7, 8 months ago. So to tag onto that, Lone Wolf Precision said, what's your favorite innovation from Haas? I'll try to answer fairly quickly, and then I'll see what your take is. I ran into Kurt Zierhut a couple years ago at the National H Tech, and the sneaky—I was going to say the sneaky bastard. He's not a bastard. The sneaky guy took his name tag off, and he was just kind of like lingering around. I was making this really cool like 5-axis thing on a UMC 500, and a bunch of people were just, you know, staying around asking questions, and he was lingering for a long time, and he was asking like curveball questions, a lot of like kind of hard questions, but. Later on, I was like, hey, I didn't get your name. We're now having a couple cocktails. And he was like, oh, I'm Kurt Zierhut. Used to work at Haas. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. So we talked about the history of the Haas control. And I'm specifically talking about the layout of the Haas control and the consistency throughout the years and all that. I personally, that is my favorite thing about the Haas machine is the usability of it, the layout of it. I use like the Bamboo printer and Apple as like user experience kind of examples. I think a lot of the industry can learn from that. My other two, the UMC, we've talked about how it changed the accessibility of 5-axis. Tooling, everything you guys are doing in tooling is great. His follow-up question was, what is something you'd like to see in the future? I want to see quarter inch shrink fit holders for Cap 40s.
We don't have quarter inch shrink fit. We only have big stuff. We don't have one.
It's ridiculous. Is it Alex Papp?
Yeah.
So I was pinging him and I'm like, what the heck? he said soon. He didn't say soon. So breaking here, he did say soon.
Dozens of engineers just just working on that type of thing right now, pulling in different products.
Yeah, that's great. So the two questions, what's your favorite innovation at Haas? And then what would you like to see in the future? I stole the best one.
Exactly. Yeah, that's that. What I like to see.
Let me serve you up with one. To me, I think Haas, and then you can do whatever you want, obviously. I think Haas changed the industry with kind of bringing, I mean, it's really accessibility of things. Probing's the one that I was poking at. I think probing, they changed how the industry looked at probing.
They really did. It's funny that you mentioned that. So there's other, now everyone's got probing on their machine. Everyone's always had probing. Renishaw's been around on every machine. Haas, when they created their interface originally with VQC and then their IPS and BPS, they got away from the G65, P9823, blah, 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 that everyone used to have to program with. We all had a single giant long program, and we would go down to a probe a bore, and we'd start there, and we'd whatever. So you have this cheater thing, but it was still just macros. The fact that you can go to the offset page on a Haas machine and say probe a corner or probe a bore or probe whatever, they were just the first ones that did that. And that was in big, large part to Rich Foley and the guys at Renishaw who programmed and made those things happen on a Haas control. There's different apps now. There's different things that can make it work, but it's definitely Haas made that stuff easy, and it's still easy. You can probe from the offset page or from the conversational side of things. That really changed things. Oddly enough, my first probes were not on Haas machines. I was running other machines.
Me too.
And so I ran it for years. And when I came back to running a Haas and then saw the offset page, I'm like, what? Why isn't everyone doing this? It was just the way it should be. So they're always getting better with that. I like we have a lot of custom templates and stuff that we can run with our what we're calling, the VQC, what the old VQC and then new VPS, the conversational programming side of things. That stuff is powerful. We just added all new routines to, the program routines with if statements. You can have it do this and that. But what's funny is Fusion's all got that built in now as well. So everyone's, got that stuff figured out, and they can just run it. The live tool lay things are always a big thing for me. So the twin spindle, dual spindle lays are kind of my favorite thing, for that, just because it's a little automatic factory. You put a bar feeder for that guy and you're running. What I'm most looking forward to is kind of along those same lines. We're getting 20-foot bar feeders. So instead of having a pair of bars to, 5-6 feet and get these things running, we're right now developing a longer bar feeder for the lay. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm excited for that. We just came out with this last week, a fiber laser. So that is exciting. It's a little bigger than what most people, it's a little too industrial, a little too big. It's a 3K laser.
Same thing that I saw at IMTS or different?
No, the one at IMTS was a smaller, I don't know how many watts it is, but that was basically just for engraving.
Oh, you're talking cutting laser.
Yeah, this thing will cut through 3/4 inch of steel. So that thing was just introduced. That's like 140 grand. It's got 10-foot by 5-foot, travels, so it can run large sheets. And so I'm excited about that. And I'm hoping that they'll go and make one kind of in between, something smaller. It's just fun to have. It does something different. But even then, 140 grand, it's an amazing machine. Might as well get the big one. So I'm excited to see what that laser can do. That one's kind of cool. There's a lot of ancillary products that we're going to be running soon. But the 20-foot bar feeder or the longer, whatever it's going to be, the longer bar feeder, I'm excited for. This fiber laser, I'm excited for. This new Boxway lathe, it'll be interesting to see how that thing cuts. But again, I'm really excited for just the software behind the machines as well. To line these guys up and just run day and night.
If you haven't, I would love to see if you've seen Datron and how they run their probing.
Vision system?
Yeah, I would love to see a day where you can go to a Haas machine and draw a circle around the part. It's pretty rad.
That's fun.
Mark, we've gone long and I super appreciate your time. I think everybody's going to love your story. Did you want to close with anything, or just wrap it up and say thanks for your time?
Let's see here. One second here. Can I share my screen?
Oh, I have no idea. I'm still new to the podcasting thing. You should be able to go right down to the bottom arrow thing.
Let me see that. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Maybe. We'll see that. Let me see if this
is like multiplied inside of it.
Oh, that's okay.
Now I see this. Yeah. This is you're looking to make a deck or show a deck?
Yeah. I was just going to show. These were just some cool pictures. We were just talking about this. This is also the
So I see right now we're back to a deck. Yeah. now I'm seeing the like
squad
thing. Oh, I see. Oh, you're inside a dam.
It's just some stuff that not everyone sees.
Yeah.
So this is the Hoover Dam. And that is a VF6 right there. Yeah. So so it's funny. We've got these machines everywhere. And I just love seeing it. It was just kind of cool. That's the bottom. And we were talking about AI. John Saunders had commented on a post that I did put out a little while ago. And he was saying, is this picture real? And so our Haas dealership was putting this thing. It's a train station at the top of the world. And so John Saunders had replied and said, hey, is this thing real? Is this an AI image? And no, it's completely real.
Awesome.
That's just a couple of pictures of some Haas machines that are everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was kind of fun. We'll stop that here. Let me see.
Thanks. There you go. That's awesome.
Fun stuff, fun pictures. But you're not the only person machining. There's like, when we talk about 1,000 machines a month, they're going somewhere. And that's why I love the trade shows. There's people that are making just the craziest things. I was talking to a fella who was making meat grinders with VF 14s. And I'm thinking, oh, a meat grinder. No, he's like, no, for cows. Like they put in like 10 cows at a time. It's the size of a room. And it comes out with ground beef. And I'm like, who
are you?
People making these weird machines all over the world. And all of our skills are transferable, whether it's for race cars or who knows what, or if it's going to the top of the world in Switzerland to keep trains going.
That's so cool. Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for sharing your story. And thanks for sharing all the knowledge that you share throughout the years. I appreciate your time. Appreciate your friendship. Hope to hear more dirt bike and motorcycle stories coming up here soon. But
absolutely.
Yeah, sounds good.
I'm looking forward to see where Toolpath takes us here in the next couple of years.
As am I. I think we're in a really important part of our industry, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your time, Mark. Have a good night.
You're on Instagram.
Yep. Cheers.